Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In an age where digital media has enabled anyone to be a critic, from blogs to restaurant reviews on Yelp, book reviews at Amazon, or movie ratings on Rotten Tomatoes, what is the role of a critic in criticism? My guest today is New York Times chief film critic A.O. Scott, who's written a book about the value of criticism as a universal intellectual and creative task. He writes that we are all critics, whether we publish in a national publication, a user review, or not at all. In his book, Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth, he writes that critical thinking informs almost every aspect of artistic creation, of civil action, and interpersonal life. He'll be talking about the art of criticism in a special Book Smart Tulsa presentation at the Circle Cinema. A.O. Scott will be speaking this evening at 7 in a free event. Scott joined the New York Times as a film critic in January 2000. Prior to that, he was a Sunday book reviewer for Newsday and a frequent contributor to Slate, the New York Review of Books, and other publications. In addition to film reviewing duties at the Times, he also writes for the Times Magazine and for the Book Review. He's a distinguished professor of film criticism at Wesleyan University and my guest today on Studio Tulsa. A.O. Scott, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, it's great to be with you.
This book, Better Living Through Criticism, it sounds like it percolated for a while. What made you decide to write this book at this particular time?
Well, I had been thinking about a lot of the issues in it for a very long time. I mean, just about what this peculiar job that I have consists of, why anyone does it, what it's good for. And over the years, I had written a few pieces kind of reflecting on it. But a few things happened that kind of encouraged me to put it together, to kind of synthesize those ideas and try to explore them in a more systematic way. And I guess the main thing was the idea that is still around, but that was really surfacing with a lot of force, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years ago, that criticism and that the critical profession was kind of obsolete and was on its way out, and that we would have, you know, we have social media so we can share all our tastes and our likes with our friends. We have algorithms from Netflix, from Amazon, that can help, you know, shape our choices and tell us what we like. And there was an idea that, well, why do we need people like me, people whose job it is to evaluate and to judge things? Can't we just do without that? I was interested in that idea. I was, you know, certainly threatened and disturbed by it, but I was also curious about, well, what's behind it? What, not only why do we think we need, or maybe think we don't need, professional critics, but what is this activity of criticism? What is it that someone like me is doing when I review a movie, but also how does that connect with what people who go to the movies are doing when they argue about what they've seen afterwards? So I really wanted to try to get as complete and kind of comprehensive a view of the issues about, not only about critics and criticism, but about taste that are always in the back of my mind when I'm writing.
And through this, you take us a journey going back to the Greeks, through the Romantic era, the great era of critics in the late 19th century and early 20th century, trying to understand what this job of being a critic is. What conclusions did you come to?
Well, partly that there's nothing new under the sun. You know, that you know, I started out very much in the present, looking at people talking about the internet and digital culture and, you know, how that had changed everything. And I found many of the same arguments happening all the way back in antiquity, in the Renaissance, in the 18th and 19th century, when you had the growth of print. I mean, one thing that I discovered that was kind of amusing was that a lot of the most alarmist ideas about the internet and digital culture, about how it destroys standards, about how you have all of these people popping up out of nowhere with these opinions and no credentials and no standing, were exactly what were disturbing people about print, about the rise of newspapers and magazines, and all of this unauthorized, just this glut of opinion and argument and bad manners that we associate with the internet and with social media.
Right. The same thing with papers as opposed to, like, journals or professional publications or things like that, right?
Exactly. It was the same kind of threat of, which is in a way the threat of democracy, of pluralism, the idea that, you know, too many voices will be a bad thing. And I kind of think that too many voices, or a lot of different voices, is a very good thing. And then I also discovered that there are these questions that never go away that are kind of the deeper philosophical questions about how do we know if something is good? How do we know that you know, one thing, one book or one painting or one piece of music is better than another? What are we saying when we're saying that? What are we basing it on? Are we basing it on our own responses, our own emotions, our own feelings, our own instincts, or are we appealing to some to something outside, to some set of standards and criteria that exist that we can apply or impose? And those are, in a way, impossible questions to answer in a kind of philosophical way, but we're always working them out in just our daily lives as we encounter different works of art and imagination. So what I found, somewhat to my surprise, was that I was engaged in a much bigger, more wide-ranging, kind of deeper project than at first I had thought. I thought I was going to write a defense of my own way of making a living, and it ended up something bigger and stranger than that.
Yes, it is indeed. And you have these wonderful dialogues in there in which they're sort of conundrums, because no decisions are reached in these things. Why include these dialogues?
Well, there were a few reasons. One, they came about partly because when I had finished a draft of the book, it was pretty much the six essays that are the main chapters of the book. And an introduction, and the introduction was terrible. And my editor said, like, this just isn't working. I just couldn't figure out how to get into the questions and set it up in a way that would be appealing and inviting to readers. So I had been reading in the course of my research. I had read, you know, gone back and read some of Plato's dialogues and also a few essays by Oscar Wilde, one called The Decay of Lying, the other called The Critic as Artist, which are written in dialogue form as these imaginary conversations between two people. And I thought, well, what if I tried to do that just as the introduction, as a way of both of kind of easing the reader into what I'm trying to do, and also to kind of make the point that what criticism is an endless argument, an endless and inconclusive dialogue, either within one's own head or with other people. And that kind of worked pretty well at the beginning and the end of the book, and I ended up deciding that a couple more of those dialogues, kind of some of the chapters, as you know, are fairly dense and fairly abstract, and these dialogues were a way of kind of letting the book breathe a little bit, opening up the argument, putting up a little more of my own personal voice and perspective in there, and also enacting that part of the book's argument, that criticism is, it's not a lecture, it's a conversation.
Before we talk about some of the sections of the book, one of the things you also was a catalyst was apparently your own sort of 5 minutes of extra critical fame when you published a review of the first Avengers film, in which, you know, you said it was a good film, but it was formulaic, and in fact, it was about making huge amounts of money for Disney and Marvel, which is not untrue. But Samuel L. Jackson took exception to that and, of course, published a Twitter about it. And all of a sudden, there was this war of what a critic's job is, why have a critic. How did that play into this book?
Well, it kind of, I had started working on the book, and it gave me, I think, a wonderful sort of set piece and a reminder of another one of these arguments that isn't new. I mean, as long as there have been critics, there have been people who have been complaining about critics and wishing, you know, we would all go away. And, you know, fans and audience members and artists and creative people taking great exception to the reviews that they get. So Samuel L. Jackson tweeted, you know, to all the Avengers fans in the world, we need to find A.O. Scott a new job, when he can actually do. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, what is the job? How do you actually do it? And I was very grateful to him and am, because then he kind of went back after we had our little Twitter battle and expanded on what he meant by this in an interview that he gave at the Huffington Post, which I found very, very refreshing, because a lot of times the people that I write about are very, I mean, I'm sure they think all kinds of terrible things about me, but they tend to be very cautious and circumspect and to ignore bad reviews rather than to call them out. So I thought it was great that he was willing to go on the record and, you know, talk about what a fool I was.
Well, and one of his points was the fact that you shouldn't be taking this serious. Of course, it's a commercial piece of business, right? And it's, as I believe he used a couple of expletives with it, but it's just a piece of pop culture. But right. At the same time, you know, there was this thing of, I worked really hard on this. This is, you know, I'm putting my art into this pop culture vehicle. Why shouldn't it be subject to criticism?
Right. Well, I think what was so interesting about what he said was that he, in a way, was kind of having it both ways, which is not unusual. That is that on the one hand, yes, this here's this beautiful, perfect thing. You know, it's a great movie. He said it's a great movie. So just leave it alone. You know, don't drag it down to your own cynical or skeptical level. Just let it exist in its own perfection. And then at the same time, you know, so that is sort of means that it's above criticism. At the same time, because it's pop culture, because it's a kind of a just a throwaway piece of entertainment, it's beneath criticism. Why bother thinking about it so much? Why bother, as he to use his word, intellectualizing it? And those are very powerful arguments, and you need to respond to them seriously in a way. And I kind of tried to rise to the challenge and say, well, to explain why I think it is important to, not only important, but inevitable that we think about and care about and judge these things that, whether they're works of high or of popular art, that make great claims on our attention, that have some sense of their own value in the world, economic if nothing else. You know, if someone is spending $200 million to make and market a movie, that seems like something maybe to take seriously. That doesn't seem trivial to me.
You know, and this gets into an area I wanted to explore, the whole idea of the power of the critic. As you went back through history, I was wondering if you know, when you think of the power of the critic, at one point it was the print critics, it was the Janet Maslins, the Pauline Kaels, and then it was people like Gene Shalit or Siskel and Ebert, not for their print, but for their television show. And this power of the critic, whether it be theatrical productions or film, right. Is that overblown? I mean, it seems. I mean, you certainly didn't hurt the Avengers at all.
Well, exactly. I think it is generally overblown, and I think it's something that people sometimes get obsessed with. So you see, you know, in popular culture, there is, you know, whether it's Addison DeWitt in All About Eve or Anton Ego in Ratatouille, critics who are sort of feared and destructive figures, and I think the actual power that critics have ever really had is pretty small, and shouldn't be the point of it. I mean, I think that I hope that people who go into who follow the path of criticism do so because they're interested in writing and thinking in truth rather than in power. But it is true that in different art forms, critics have wielded and continue to wield power in different ways. It's certainly true that. You know, the Broadway theater in New York has been very much influenced by what critics, in particular, I think critics at the New York Times, have done. And I think it's still possible for, in some cases, for critics to make or break a production. I think that the same is sometimes true now in restaurant criticism, where there's a sense, you know, of enormous economic consequences for a high-profile bad review and maybe also for a good one. I think in movies it's a little different because movies are such big commercial popular entertainments, at least the Hollywood ones are, that it doesn't matter, you know, what I say about the Avengers or about Batman versus Superman or, you know, any of those kind of big franchise movies. On the other hand, I think that critics can have a positive influence in alerting people to the existence and the interest of stuff that they might not have known about or might have been under the radar. So I think that it is possible for critics of all different kinds in all different disciplines to do the important work of connecting audiences with work that they might be interested in that they might not have known about otherwise.
You know, I kind of think of it as like the Avengers thrown into different formats. You know, a critic really can't harm a Broadway musical that is a you know, it's a good time, but it's formulaic and it's, you know, because you see hits like that where critics do pan it. It's more It's more when the subject matter is about perhaps a higher art, mm-hmm. you know, a drama, a small play in which a critic has more influence, I think.
I think that's true. And I think that's partly because part of the critic's job is to make a case and to do some explaining, you know, that there's work that can be challenging that isn't immediately accessible in a way, but that nonetheless is worthwhile, and it sometimes can just be helpful, you know, to have a companion or a guide, to, you know, not only trying to persuade you to see it, but to help you make sense of it. And I think that is definitely part of the work of the critic too. And I mean, I certainly feel that way about art forms that I'm not as up on, that I don't know as much about. I mean, I definitely when I go to classical music concerts or listen to classical music or jazz, I want critics around who I can read, who can tell me not only, you know, tell me what to pay attention to, what I should be listening for, why this particular thing that my untrained ears might not have heard is so interesting or so new or so powerful.
My guest today is Tony Scott, A.O. Scott, the chief film critic for the New York Times. His new book is titled Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. It's published by Penguin Press. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Circle Cinema for a BookSmart Tulsa event, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. A big part of this book goes to this idea of figuring out how to tell that story through objectivity, taste, and these are big, essential questions that you're tackling in these essays.
I think they are, and I think, I mean, I tried to do it in a way that wouldn't be boring or overwhelming or intimidating. I mean, I really try to locate these questions in experiences that we all share. I mean, I take it that we're all interested in something. We're all interested in art, in pleasure, in beauty. We all have some desire to expand the circle of our experience, and we're curious, and we want to see what other people have done and what other people have made, and that's all partly about our ongoing attempt to kind of understand our lives as human beings. So what I call criticism is part of that work, and part of the work that we're all doing. So the book is not just for specialists, and isn't just about the particular job that I'm fortunate enough to do, but about the activity that's underneath that job that everyone's doing.
Earlier in our conversation, we were talking about how we sort of alluded to the democratization of criticism, that, you know, everyone can be a critic now, whether it's doing ratings that are sort of amalgamated into a rating on, say, Rotten Tomatoes, or writing actual reviews, whether it be on restaurants, on hotels, on travel attractions, on Yelp. You know, there's all these vehicles to someone's own blog.
Yeah.
How's that changed the critical field? I mean, everyone can be a critic now.
it has changed it, and it's made it, you know, it can be overwhelming, and you can sometimes feel that your own voice is in danger of being drowned out in all of these other voices. But I think it also kind of throws into relief that it is something that everyone can do, but it's not necessarily easy to do it well, you know. And you can, even if you're going on Yelp score, you know, on Yelp or TripAdvisor ratings or whatever, looking for a hotel or you know, or a plumber or something like that, you will find that some of it is useful and helpful and clear and seems trustworthy, and other stuff is just kind of crazy or mean-spirited or dumb. and in a way, it's always been that way. There have always been, you know, better and worse examples of criticism. What I like is the sense that the pressure, in a way, that this puts on me and on other professional critics, and on serious amateur critics as well, to do it as well as we can, you know, to write in such a way and express ourselves in such a way that it can stand out, that it can be useful, that it can attract people's attention and interest. The other thing that I really like about the digital world that I inhabit more and more is that the dialogue that's always been there implicitly is now literally there. So, you know, writing is a very lonely process, and often what happens is you publish something, even if you publish in the New York Times, it used to be, it would sort of go out into the world, and I'd get a couple letters or a couple emails, but you wouldn't know what anyone thought of it, or whether anyone agreed with it, or what mistakes you made. And now you can hear a lot of that. And it does, I do feel kind of closer to my readers and more involved in a real conversation.
Really? And that sometimes that feedback is almost instantaneous too.
Yeah. And sometimes it's very unpleasant. But it's often, you know, it's often worth, you know, worth seeing, and sometimes it's very gratifying, you know, to see like a lot of people or a number of people, you know, who have gone to see the movie come back and engage with what I've said about it.
Just a moment ago, you talked about how a lot of this democratization of criticism is mean-spirited, and that is the reputation of a professional critic, that somehow that in criticizing you're being mean-spirited about it. How do you respond to that you're being unfair by being mean-spirited while providing criticism? Is that just the nature of the beast?
I think it is, and I think it is one of the myths about criticism in a way is that it's motivated by spite or envy or hostility, which when you think about it is very, very strange idea. Like why anyone would devote so much of their time and you know try to make a living involved with something that they hate. You know, like why would I go to the movies six times a week or more if I actually didn't like movies? As it happens, I really do like movies, and almost every critic that I know, and every critic who is any good at it and laughs, is motivated by enthusiasm, by affection, by love. But sometimes that love is disappointed or betrayed, and our job is to be not to be negative, but to be honest. And sometimes that truth hurts, and sometimes we have to deliver that truth in a way that can seem cruel. I mean, there's the whole phenomenon of the there are negative reviews that are a guilty pleasure to write because it's a lot of fun to take revenge on, you know, you had 2 hours of your life wasted by some stupid movie, and the way you get that back is by having fun at the movies. And at least, you know, hoping to entertain your readers in the way that the movie didn't entertain you.
But I would imagine even for a professional critic, as it is for anybody when they're seeing a piece of art or culture, that sometimes you just don't get it.
Yes, sometimes you do, and you have to try. You have to figure out. I think this is the thing that in a way, you know, identifies professional critics is that you have to do the work to figure out how to get it, how to write about what it is and how to understand it, how to overcome your own ignorance, which doesn't mean you have to learn to like it, but you have to at least learn to understand maybe why you don't like it.
Now, one section of the book is how to be wrong. And yeah, certainly that is also, if you're a real critic, you will have been really wrong about things at some point or another. And so what are the best ways to be How do you be wrong?
Well, you can't help it. I mean, you're not wrong on purpose. You're trying very hard to get it right. But you can be blinded by your own taste. You can be you can just also be out of step with the movement of history in a way. One of the things that fascinates me most is how tastes change, how opinions change, how something that looked like a masterpiece when it came out to critics, to audiences, can look can use up its interest or can look kind of mediocre or even bad a generation or less later. Or conversely, how something that was dismissed or forgotten or made fun of when it first came out turns out on later reflection to be a great masterpiece.
I think you use the example.
I'm fascinated by how that change happens.
Use the example of bringing up Baby in the book, which was sort of dismissed as a lightweight screwball comedy, not sort of the form of the screwball comedy, the sort of the piece de resistance.
Exactly, and it's I cite a review by the New York Times critic at the time, Frank Nugent, who went on to be a screenwriter. He wrote the screenplay for the Searchers and other John Ford westerns, and he wrote a 4 or 5 paragraph brutal dismissal of bringing up Baby that reminded me of some of the reviews that I might write, you know, of like bad Adam Sandler movies, where he's just kind of rolling his eyes saying, this is all cliche, this is all, it's the people are so annoying, it's so, and he just gives it, you know, the back of it, of his hand. And you look at it now and you say, what was, you know, how could he have missed that? How could he have not seen what a wonderful, sparkling, you know, brilliant movie that is? Although there are still some people who don't like it. It's fascinating. I was teaching a class in film criticism to college students this spring, and they were mostly film studies majors, and I kind of asked them, you know, what is a movie that you feel like you should like, but you just, you know, can't stand? And a number of them, more than a handful, five or six, cited Bringing Up Baby. You know, that they'd had to watch it in their History of Hollywood class, and it was being, you know, presented to them as a great masterpiece of screwball comedy, and they just thought it was ridiculous and boring. So maybe that the wheel is turning again and coming around to Frank Nugent. But it's because I think that anything that's interesting, any work of art that's interesting, is going to be in some way divisive. Is going to rub some people the wrong way and really excite other people. And to be on any side, to take a stand and to take a side and take a position, which is what critics have to do, is to risk being wrong or to invite an attempt to prove you wrong, to refute what you've said.
Well, and it goes back to one of the points of your book. It says, you know, the work of art, if it is a work of art, it will be enduring, yet the criticism is fleeting.
Yeah, I mean, the criticism kind of gets absorbed into the history of the work of art. Although there are still some works of criticism that do stand the test of time. But I think that criticism is an art form, but it is an essentially modest one, because I think it you're not doing it in a way to last. I don't think people might paint or sculpt or make films or write novels and say, well, this is, you know, this will last forever. I don't usually think that a review I'm writing for Friday's paper will last beyond, you know, say the following Tuesday.
Well, we wish you great success. We'll look forward to your appearance. Better Living Through Criticism. Tony Scott, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
A.O. Scott is the chief film critic for the New York Times and the author of Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. It's published by Penguin Press. He'll be a guest of Booksmart Tulsa and the Circle Cinema tonight in a joint presentation tonight at 7 o'clock. The event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.